The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns, Gear, and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain.
If we talk about a near peer threat, how AMC fits in that piece, because there are definitely some challenges. I know, like the C-17, for instance, data link it's been on the table, I think, since 2012. And here we are 12 years later, no data link, a legacy defensive systems. So balling all that up, what are your thoughts?
Yep. So I was hired to this job because of my experience in the Pacific. You know, I've got two tours in Korea, two tours at Indo-PACOM, and then a tour at PACAP. It's not really a celebratory cause. I mean, this is insight into our future. A contested environment, very long distances, not a whole lot of communication. A joint force that needs to be integrated tactically as the situation is developing. I mean, there's a whole lot of things we need to work on. I don't think war's inevitable. Yeah, I'm pretty clear of that in the opening line. I hope I'm wrong. I don't think war's inevitable. And there's no consensus on any timeline. Is have a team that's ready to take the field, and not just take the field, but deliver victory for America. I'm not trying to make a statement for the commercial industry. I'm trying to make a statement on what this team needs to be successful in the AOR. When it comes to the Pilot Plus One, and when it comes to the around the world flight, it's all about an organization's ability to understand, mitigate, and own risk.
General Minahan, thanks for joining me on the podcast. It's an honor to have you on here. Before we do that, I do want to say thank you to your staff, Voodoo, for connecting us, your staff for making this happen. I know you're incredibly busy with not a lot of white space on the calendar. So again, thank you to you for joining me, but Tiffany over there in PA shop for making this all happen. It's been a lot of time in the work. So thank you again.
Yeah, it's great. I'm fortunate. I've been surrounded by amazing teams for 34 years. This team is exceptional in every regard. It's an honor to be with you today. I'm excited. You talk about a busy schedule. You know, that schedule is busy because, you know, we're here to take care of airmen, here to take care of mission. So it's appropriate that it's busy. But I'm very fortunate to have this invitation and look forward to a chat. We got two things in common. Your Georgia Tech ties. My son went to Georgia Tech and played football for them. So I tried after he graduated to just go back to Auburn football, but I couldn't do it. So the Jackets are going to be a part of my life forever, and it was a treat to be associated with. I'm very proud of him for doing that. The second is that you're a Robin Olds fan, and so am I. So I love the book Fighter Pilot, and it's a thinly disguised leadership manual that, you know, I was fortunate to come across, you know, many years ago, but I still have that one on my mantle and use it to guide me. So it's really cool that we have those two things in common.
I love it. That should be mandatory reading, I think, for every person in the military.
I agree. You know, my stuff's all packed up now. If this had happened a few weeks ago, I would actually have the book sitting here. You know, there's a page somewhere around 262 that just goes through, you know, a very precise approach to leadership that he took. You know, how it's about the team, not the individual, how you praise in public, correct in private. It's not about slogans. It's about, you know, the deliberate generation of air power. I mean, it's just gold there. And when I need the reset, I go back to that highlighted dog-eared page and reset myself to remind me about what's important.
You know, it's interesting. I think about more with the flying aspect and him going to the F-4 in Vietnam and taking that wingman role, learning, you know, the ropes, if you will, from the seasoned guys who are much younger than him and that were his subordinates, going out there, working his way out to be on point. Versus there are some air forces, and I'm curious to get your take, being at the level you operate, going to red flag for me. That's probably my exposure. When you work with some other nations, that humility is not there. The rank comes off in the debrief, in our debriefs, and, you know, if you are the wing commander and you miss your sword or you mess something up, like, you're going to get called out. Some other nations, maybe not so much. You got that a rank gradient where people are afraid to say something or they won't say something or it's not acceptable. What are your thoughts on that? Have you seen that?
I'd say overall, you know, a couple things. You know, the debrief, I think, is one of the most sacred institutions in our Air Force. You know, that we come in, and we have the courage and the respect for each other to say what needs to be said and hold each other accountable. You know, and you can do that by preserving dignity. It doesn't have to come at the expense of dignity. You know, to a certain extent, I believe that's why call signs exist. I mean, you can hold many accountable in the debrief for the, you know, the lack of plan, the rejoin, you know, the time control, all the things, right? But you can preserve Captain Minahan, Major Minahan, Lieutenant Colonel Minahan, you know, Colonel General, all those things. And so, you know, the sacredness of the debrief, I think, is what makes us unique. And so I don't have a comment on you know, the other nations and their approach to it. But, you know, when it comes to the Air Force that I cherish and an Air Force that needs to be emulated, it's about how do you get in that debrief room and really hold each other accountable so that you can improve together, you know, so that we can get after mission, so that you can make, you know, better flight leads, better package leads, better mission commanders, and then certainly better wingmen, aircraft commanders, all of the things. So I think it's a good comment, but it's interesting to tie that to a call sign. You know, why do call signs exist? They exist so we hold each other accountable and preserve the dignity of the officer behind them.
And time to learn is when you're training, because when you cross the line, that's not the best time to figure it out because the consequences are much higher. So we're going to talk about that a little later on down the road, but I think it's an interesting take there. So slight digression there, but I wanted to kick it off with, I noticed the last month or so you had your Finney flight.
I did.
34 years in the Air Force flying. What were some of the thoughts going through your mind surrounding the Finney flight?
Yeah, it's extremely surreal. To be me right now, you know, as you know, I feel like a lieutenant on the inside still. I realize I look like my dad, but on the inside, you know, I've got that spark of the lieutenant that, you know, is executing plan A. You know, I grew up in an Air Force family. My grandfather was an Air Force pilot in World War II and Korea. You know, and I begged that guy to tell me war stories on the foot of my bed, you know, whenever I was around him. So, you know, plan A was be a pilot in the United States Air Force. And then when that's coming to a conclusion is where the surreal part enters. So, you know, doing things for the last time, you know, is fairly emotional. You know, flying and that aircraft, especially the C-130, you know, define who I am as a father, who I am as a husband, who I am as an airman, who I am as a leader, you know, all the things. I'm not saying that that doesn't exist for other people in different airframes. I'm just telling you that's my tribe. And the opportunity that I had for this command was born from the earliest days flying the C-130. I describe the first three squadrons I had. You know, the first squadron taught me the nobility of what we do, the nobleness of what we do. They're old Vietnam, the last of the Vietnam guys, you know, that were approaching their 20 years. You know, your value to that squadron was based on your performance in the cockpit. Bottom line, if you didn't perform in the cockpit, then every other part of your life was challenged. So we grew up very early understanding what it meant to show up at the brief ready to go, what it meant to be, you know, crisp on the radios, what it meant to be to fly a good jet, what it meant to run the checklists, you know, all that stuff was the nobility. The second one taught me the discipline. You know, I had a wonderful ops officer and then later on Commander Mark Fritchie, who was all about the discipline. How do you build a crew? How do you prepare? How do you plan? And, you know, I don't think I ever got anything through him on the first time. You know, but the guy encouraged me, you know, his words, you gotta get into the batter's box, dig in, and swing away. And then the last, the third squadron taught me the command of what we do. Had a wonderful commander named Doug Krulin, who really showed me how it all came together and that inspirational leadership and how you hold each other accountable, but you also build each other up. And so those three things all came together on my Finney flight at Little Rock Air Force Base earlier in the year. So, you know, I described it that I ended my flying with all the teams that began my flying, you know, and so that Little Rock team came together a wonderful mission into northern Arkansas, you know, flying in some fantastic terrain. The state is amazing in their support for the Little Rock Air Force Base and its mission. And so, you know, I'm elated because I'm flying, and on the inside, I'm weeping because I know that it's the last time that I'm doing it. But it couldn't have gone any better. I'm gonna hold it up as a memory that I'll cherish for the rest of my life. And I'm extremely appreciative about the entire FlyFix support team that made it happen. And then that airplane, you know, doing it in that airplane is just the walk-off home run.
I love it. I can't imagine the difference between the C-130 you started in,
yeah,
and the C-130J. That's got to be, yeah, drastic.
It's really cool. So, you know, in fact, we were up at Corona last month, and there's a C-130 in the Air Force Museum that I actually flew into the museum when I was the wing commander at Little Rock. It's a 1962 model. It has a DFC associated with it because it took a mortar in Vietnam in which the flight engineer was killed. And then they still completed the mission. And, you know, I got to fly that up there when I was the wing commander. The aircraft commander met me when we landed at Wright Pat, and there was a ceremony, right? So, I mean, imagine you're on an older part of the airfield that's very rarely used. You're taxiing up. There's some bleachers. There's a podium. You can tell there's a ceremony going on. A Vietnam veteran greets me that, you know, was, you know, highly decorated and extremely brave during that war. I'm flying his airplane, and the airplane had actually just come out of supporting operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. And my first words to him were, "Hey, sir, I know a lot of things, but this airplane, as amazing as it is, doesn't want to be in the museum. It's still got life in her." So those old airplanes are amazing. And the majority of my hours are in 1963 to 1974 model C-130s. Break. The J is amazing. You know, people always warn you when you get in the J and you're an old guy like me, they always say, hey, it's going to take you a while to get used to the HUD, you know, the mission computer, all that other stuff. But I'll tell you, it didn't take me long to fall in love with that HUD. I mean, it really frees the crew member to really focus on the things that only humans can do, you know, to understand how the mission, how the flight is developing, to understand the dynamics between the package. It's just an incredible, incredible airplane, and it's got less crew members. You know, I love saying that I grew up with navigators and flight engineers. They're essential to my growth and who I am. And it's not a but, and that airplane is amazing. And Jay, so, I adapted to the technology very good. And I'm certainly in awe of the team that maximizes what that airplane can do.
It's, well, I'll tell you what, the HUD, seeing that thing, it's massive. I was like,
yeah,
you have to look all around, yeah, but
it's like a drive-in movie screen. It's huge.
Oh, well, I would like to kind of pivot here and dig into AMC's, where it is today, where it was, where it's going. And specifically we talk about like a near peer fight. So,
right.
I know you put out a memo. I'd like to talk about that as well. But before we get going with that, if we talk about a near peer threat, how AMC fits in that piece, because there are definitely some challenges. I know like the C-17, for instance, data link it's been on the tables, I think, since 2012. And here we are 12 years later, no data link, legacy defensive systems. So balling all that up, what are your thoughts?
Yep. So I was hired to this job because of my experience in the Pacific. You know, I've got two tours in Korea, two tours at Indo-PACOM, and then a tour at PACAF. So, you know, my time, that all that adds up to about 10 years. And, you know, I think as the chief was considering who to come in Air Mobility Command, he was thinking about certainly, three administrations worth of pivot to the Pacific, National Defense Strategy under President Trump, National Defense Strategy under President Biden, and how do we really get after what it means to, you know, get Air Mobility Command oriented on that? You know, one of my very first meetings when I came in is I put a map on the table, on a conference room table, and I said, demonstrate to me what we're going to do if this goes down. And from that map on a table, it grew into a map on the theater floor, to a map in a hangar. And that was really the genesis of you know, the trajectory that we have AMC on right now. So quit talking about exercises, quit doing tabletops, and describe to me what this team is going to do if the A2 walks in there tomorrow morning and says, we're going. And, you know, I learned this from my experience with the Army and my experience with the Navy that have this rehearsal of concept approach instead of exercise and tabletops. Is how does a commander stand on a big map and say, on order, I will? And so that has matured into where we are today, where, you know, if you look at some of my earlier statements on, you know, problem statements, you know, we're not as ready, integrated, and as agile as we need to be. We're not prepared to fight and win inside the first island chain. And if you can describe what your problem statements are, then you can describe your analytical approach to solve them. Do I need to adjust? Do I need to get better value out of the things I have now? That's normally TTPs, which I'm sure you're going to bring up later. Examples are like max endurance operation. Is there value out there that exists that I simply don't have? You know, can I collaborate with AFSOC and look at the connectivity and the link solutions that they've worked into their fleet and take that value and simply buy it and put it on my fleet? And then if those two aren't an option, then we ask American industry to develop a technology that doesn't exist yet. You know, so there's this develop, you know, next generation airlift systems, NGAS, or next generation airlift, NGAL. So those analytical approaches are very important on how you go forward with the problem statement. So I think we've demonstrated pretty aggressively that we're going down each one of those lanes, certainly. You see that all come together somewhat in the Mobility Guardian exercise we did in 23 out in the Pacific. But, you know, make no mistake that we are trying to be relevant in the theater of consequence, you know, which has been identified as the pacing challenge, which is China and the Pacific. Okay. And we are aggressively going after it. I use a phrase, we are the most relied upon force in the history of warfare. So I've yet to be challenged on that statement. I don't say it from a position of arrogance nor a position seeking sympathy, okay? I'm simply saying that is everybody's counting on us to be successful. So if that's the going in statement, if I have to be successful to support ACE, if I have to be successful to support EABO, if I have to be successful to support MDTF, then this team has got to be really, really on point, you know, to explode into theater, to not only do tip-fit, but also to maneuver. All the things that come with the, you know, the tyranny of distance and the tyranny of water in the Pacific, then that's kind of been our guiding friction, our guiding tension, you know, is that we've got to be ready to handle that. You know, I'm certain you'll ask me, you know, there's some data points that, you know, you need to follow up on what it's been like to watch this team in action, because this team is on point. And despite all the operations that's happened over the last 3 years, we have to lean into the challenge that is the Pacific. So, you know, connectivity, the link that you described, the max endurance operations, the integration with the joint force that we'll be supporting, the integration with the planning to the combatant commands that we will be supporting, those are all part of the calculus and how we've been moving and how we need to move forward.
So with that, I've been critical of the KC-46. It's a 767 platform. The 76 has been around for 30 plus years. The tankering platform, albeit the KC-46 has some modifications that are different from other ones. You know, it takes us 20 years to get it into theater. But when we talk like Link 16 or even Data Link, bringing that capability to the fight for Mobility Command, comparatively speaking, while it is a big lift and it's expensive, like it should be relatively easy to implement, but like things like those roadblocks, what are the roadblocks to making things like that coming online for the warfighter?
Yep. I mean, there's clearly frustrations with the deficiencies, right?
Your online security has never been more important. Recently, hackers stole over 2.9 billion records from national public data. You might be asking yourself, what's national public data? Well, That's the service that private investigators, companies, and staffing services all use to do background checks. This information is now in the hands of hackers who say they're going to give away this information for free. I use a company called Aura to make sure that whenever my data pops up in places I don't want, I get notified immediately. They also go right to work trying to remove your information from data brokers, as well as they offer a whole host of other tools. And should the worst case happen, they offer up to $5 million in identity theft protection insurance. Protect yourself and your family today with Aura. You can use the link down below and get a 14-day free trial, and this will be enough time for Aura to go out there, scan the web, and see what information is out there that you really don't want. You can go to aura.com/afterburn or click the link down below in the description, again, to get 14 days free.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Visit kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And so, you know, I'm grateful that there's a relationship with all the stakeholders that we can address those head on and move through them. You know, at the end of the day, when I showed up, you know, we had a fleet of KC-46 and a timeline to get the receiver certification that was, you know, what I felt was too long. You know, so I made an immediate commitment to get those certifications lined up and knocked out. So, you know, we put it out in the field. We went to Europe. We went to the Pacific. We did all the things to get everything lined up so that it, you know, this is part of the analytical approach where I said, let's make best use of the value we have. I mean, I've got a brand new airplane. It certainly has some things that we're working through, but I've got a fly fix support team that's magnificent in operating it. And I need to get it out in the field and start working these bugs out and testing the true operational capabilities of the jet. So what that certification process led to is we've got everything done except the A-10. And where the A-10 lays right now, if we needed it tomorrow, I would sign it off. So we got enough reps and enough insights and analytics that, you know, that we could get that done if needed. But it also allowed us to get immediately into the operations that were happening. So it played a big role in Ukraine early, you know, getting the elements that needed to get out of the CONUS and getting it into Europe. It played an enormous part of Mobility Guardian in 23. And then we came out of Mobility Guardian in 23. We thought we were going to have a fall, a fairly relaxed fall. And now all of a sudden we're supporting operations in the Middle East with respect to Israel, Gaza, and all those things. So, and it's performed magnificently. So, you know, there are things that we need to aggressively fix and that we are going after that can make it better. The connectivity. Is certainly, you know, it does have some more robust connectivity and it has some more connectivity that needs to be invested in, including what's on the jet and bringing the comm suite up to standards, if you will, but also the roll on, roll off connectivity, which I'm really focused on for the entire fleet. This is not big, expensive stuff. This is not things that we have to invent and test. These are capabilities that exist now. And I don't know if you saw me. I testified in front of the House Armed Services Committee last week. You know, these are things that exist now that make everybody's life better. The entire joint force benefits by a connected mobility fleet. Whether you're a soldier, sailor, airman, marine, Coast Guard, or Guardian, everybody benefits from us being connected. I can sense where the enemy is. I can sense where blue is. I can sense if the airfield is open or closed. I can understand what's changed in the last 9 hours since I took off and took my intel brief. All those things don't exist right now. You know, if I'm operating off of old intel, I've got amazing crews that will make wonderful decisions, but they'll make them based on the latest information and situational awareness that they have. And we have got enormous ground to improve on here. when it comes to connectivity. Last thing, and I know I'm running long here. The last thing I'll say is connectivity is the biggest contributor to survivability. If I am forced to key a mic like our grandparents were, then I will be forced to operate those airplanes in the exact same manner without the latest situational awareness, without the intel, without the knowledge of blue and red. And, you know, we'll make the best decision possible, but it may not be the best decision for the joint force. So this connectivity is huge.
What are your thoughts? I mean, what does that look like to get to the connectivity where we need to be? What's that road forward from here?
Yeah, I think the road forward for me is industry has been wonderful. There's probably five kits out there that are roll on, roll off. You know, the two I'll mention right now are Arctic real-time information in the cockpit and Atoms, you know, which are a roll-on kit that have mild modifications to the airplane. So think access to power, access to an antenna, and then think a server kit that comes on and allows that tablet, computer, display for the crew that can automatically see, have access to the link, that can automatically have access to the latest intel and situational awareness. You know, so I think that, you know, the approach initially, and, you know, the term I coined is, you know, 25% of the fleet by 2025, that's about 250 airplanes using round numbers. I would distribute that evenly across all of the airplanes that I fly so I can get a solid statement on how it benefits all the mission sets. I would certainly put it to use in all of the operations and exercises, especially in the Pacific. And then I would have that portfolio approach to the kits that we roll on. I would collect data and have us streamline in 26 and beyond to something that's probably more refined. We would understand which kit works better than others. And then we would commit to that to get the entire mobility fleet connected. And then more importantly, we would have an enormous statement on the next generation of airlift and the next generation of tanker that would come on and say, well, here's what we've learned over the past 5 or 6 years. Here's the connectivity we need baked into the next generation so that it's not a roll-on, roll-off kit, but an open architecture, relevant, able to hang with all the technology swings, and be relevant on the battlefield, whether it's brand new or 5 or 10 years old.
All right, last piece on the connectivity, and I let it go, but this way I can survive the roll call with my C-17 weapons officer buddies. Okay. But so, you know, again, we look at 12 years gap of getting it. What's to say it's not going to be another 12 years? Is it a priority or?
Yeah, I mean, it's my number one priority. I don't think that there are things that I can do to articulate it any more than I have. And at the same time, I still need to keep beating the drum on this. You know, so I've learned a few things in the last 3 years. You know, you've got to will things into existence. You've got to wither the internal and external resistance. And then you've got to weather the personal and professional attacks. You know, so there is an operational need. Okay, it's data informed. Okay, from the evacuation of Kabul, to the support for Ukraine, to the support for Israel, to the airdrops in Gaza, to the Niger operations that we're doing now. Those are data-based operational examples of the connectivity we need. And so in each one of those, including Mobility Guardian, we showed what connectivity can bring to the joint force, not just the mobility force. So, you know, to your roll call scrubbing that you're going to get on this, you know, I am aligned with the operator on the field. We have got to go faster. This is a now thing, not a future thing when it comes to connectivity. You have more connectivity in your car and in your personal life on your cell phone than the majority of the airlift fleet has out there executing operations on behalf of the nation and our partners and allies every day. So, you know, I think we're going to get there. And I think it's going to be hard getting there. So I'll continue to run through the tape on connectivity when it comes to my tenure here at Air Mobility Command. And I'm certain that the next leader will do the same.
Perfect. Thanks, sir. All right. I want to pivot to the memo that it caught a lot of attention that you put out in 2023. To summarize, 2025, be ready for the fight with China. And down to the weeds here, again, for those who haven't read it, but making every AMC personnel qualify on a 7-meter target with a 9mm. Like that's where we're going with it. Looking back over the last 18 months or so since the memo has come out, what are your thoughts on the progress, what needs to be done, and, you know, any changes you would make to this?
Yep. So the memo was leaked and was an order to my force with the benefit at the time of about a year and a half in the seat. So somewhat concerned that I needed to get a broader message out to more people within Air Mobility Command, you know, after a year and a half. So, you know, it's called the memo. It's really an order. And it was an order teed up, you know, to really put us in a fantastic position for Mobility Guardian. So I don't think war's inevitable. And I'm pretty clear of that in the opening line. I hope I'm wrong. I don't think war's inevitable. And there's no consensus on any timeline, you know. So the best thing I can do to obey the oath that I took that says, well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office upon which I'm about to enter, is have a team that's ready to take the field, and not just take the field, but deliver victory for America. So it certainly caught a lot of attention. You know, the memo was slightly modified and stands. I stand by it. And it is responsible for the success we had in Mobility Guardian and the success we've had getting some of the mobility issues in a more proper spotlight. So when it comes to a commander's responsibility to generate a ready force, that ready force can both deter that an adversary or potential adversary would look at us and say, I don't want any piece of that. Okay. And it can also deliver decisive victory that if they're not deterred and they choose to take us on, that there's so much readiness that it delivers the decisive victory that this nation and this world needs. So you get a 2-for-1 out of that readiness, and that's the readiness we're trying to generate. You know, a team that understands what's at stake and understands our role in ensuring both that deterrence and that decisive victory lens. And then I think, you know, probably a big part of the memo was also describing the risks that I'm willing to take in getting that force, that there's some urgency and action here that are much different than the year prior, and that we can describe operations that we're going to doing, a willingness to take risk in a different light, and an urgency that requires us to do things very quickly and not negate all the other stuff that, you know, our commander concerns. You know, I don't want to take reckless risk. I'm not interested in spilling butter or scraping paint, but I am interested in a sharp departure from the status quo. So here we are 3 years, you know, 3 years at the end of my 3-year command, you know, less about a year and a half after the memo and the follow-on memos, if you will, I would say that they have been very effective in driving that action and urgency to get to where we are. Last thing on this, and I'm certain you have a follow-up, is, you know, we'll be graded at the end of the day in the battle skies in some future conflict, you know, whether it happens in 1 year, 2 years, or 5 years or 10. But, you know, we get paid to be worthy of America's blood and treasure. And that means we put a team on the field that's ready to win. Coming out of OAR, I was not in the seat for OAR, but coming out of OAR, you know, the most common debrief from those that executed was, I sure wish I'd have known the environment I was getting into. It's not a command fault of that, but that's what I'm trying to describe in this memo, you know, that we're here to support the joint team, that at the end of the day, we're all about lethality. And at the end of the day, we're all about the things it takes the entire joint team to win. So all that kind of colluded, and I think we're in a good spot because of it. At the end of the day, that was a command order from a commander to set the team to be ready to win. Over.
Well, that's what I think, you know, reading it, the, yeah, I mean, it's a shot across the bow. It's a wake up call. I've talked on the podcast about other aspects. I just had an engineer back in May talking about control systems and hacking. Like if we going to war with China, it is a bad deal all the way around. Like the world changes, and if not, the world might even end, right? Like that's how significant something like this would be. So hopefully it doesn't happen. But I think people talking about this more is an important thing.
Yep.
And obviously the past 15 years where it started trickling in, we got to start pivoting towards the Pacific and looking towards the Pacific because China's made it known. I mean, they want to be the world superpower. So can we coexist? I think so. But, you know, if it ever comes down to it, and again, hopefully it doesn't, you got to be ready for it. So,
yeah, you know, a position of readiness is where we need to be, you know, and that provides the best, that provides the best for mission, the best for airmen, certainly. And then the best options for our elected officials is, you know, the last thing we want to do is, regardless of who the adversary or potential adversary might be, is have a force that's not prepared. So, I mean, there is, you know, an enormous amount of equities here that matter, you know, for, you know, your team that's listening, you know, there's those that have been commanders, those that will be commanders, those that are responsible for mission. You know, we've got a duty to be ready. And that's what I intend to be.
Yeah, I guess with that, I'd like to actually kind of jump back into the KC-46, the round the world flight that just happened, because you alluded to the aspect of having capabilities that are in your arsenal. So recently, KC-46 completed a round the world flight nonstop. It refueled, I think, one B-2, a couple C-17s over 45 hours.
Yep.
Obviously, a team watching that crew operate, and I'm sure taking a lot of notes of how it all went, but talk to me a little bit about bringing that capability, the need for that capability, and why.
Yeah. Refueled two Eagles in the AOR as well, which was,
there we go. Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. So it's,
this wasn't about setting a record. Okay. This is about the capabilities and the attributes that this force is going to need to be successful, you know, in the Pacific theater. So, you know, going all the way back to that, you know, not ready enough, not agile enough, not integrated enough. That whole, you know, that whole problem statement is, you know, intended to, you know, we're getting after that problem statement with capabilities like this. You know, and there's a pilot plus one pilot, one boom mission we did very early. And that mission specifically really helped us categorize and identify a risk model. We normally only talk about risk in the negative sense. You know, normally risk is talked about after something goes wrong. You know, how do you talk about risk in terms of success? How do you do a model? I learned this, you know, during my time associated with, you know, people much smarter than me, especially, you know, the special operations community. But how do you create a model that says, if this is the case and you do this, then this is the result? So an if and then, which is another way to say, how do you understand the risk, mitigate the risk, and then own the risk? You know, so what the one pilot, one boom mission did is it had us very deliberately go through those new risk models in terms of what we wanted to do to be able to operate differently. LeMay did this in World War II. I mean, LeMay picked more gas and bombs over co-pilots and radio men. I mean, this is not new territory for the Air Force, okay? I'm not trying to make a statement for the commercial industry. I'm trying to make a statement on what this team needs to be successful in the AOR, okay? So when it comes to the pilot plus one, and when it comes to the around the world flight, it was all about an organization's ability to understand, mitigate, and own risk. I don't know the last time you stayed up 2 days, you know, but it probably wasn't a very easy thing. You know, I was on a 40-hour plus mission in the beginning of Mob Guard. It took me 4 weeks to recover from it. I'm not looking to do these things routinely. I'm looking to do them when we have to. And I don't want to figure these things out when the conflict or crisis is happening. I want to figure them out now where I can take the time to really get the insights and the data and the analysis that I need. So the planning required for this was immense. The human performance part of this was immense. We had flight surgeons, we had wearables, we had simulators that warmed up to it. We had sleep cycles altered days in advance. And then just the precision of refueling, which you know personally on the receiving end, you know, is a very precise time and place. And think about all the variables of what it takes to come out of the CONUS, negotiate the Pacific, you know, go through the Middle East and all those things, and to still hit precise times and place is an enormous statement on the capabilities of this team and all the other teams that made it happen, the AOCs, the planners, the receivers, all that other stuff. And then to do it in a fashion that, you know, that actually demonstrates not just the risk that we're willing to take to get better, but also demonstrate the risk mechanisms so that you're not surprised en route. So I'm pretty proud of the team. The record is the least of my concerns. The precise navigation execution, you know, human factors, the FlyFix support team that made it happen, all those things are what we need to focus on. We've got an enormous data set now from everything from the exercises we're performing in, specifically Mobility Guardian, to now this operational one that went around the world. We'll continue to work all that forward and get to a point where I think we've got a very good, solid concept of operations as it applies. And then we'll continue to work things forward to make it more and more successful.
Well, I don't have any inside baseball with this. I can make some, I have made some assumptions with it, right? So now I'm flying big planes. I just finished a 6-day trip literally around the world, and I'm, you know, a zombie when I get back. So I'm hypercritical of single pilot ops. I obviously did a lot of single pilot stuff previous life, which is great. Now flying big planes, 14 hours, you go in, you're like, it takes a team to make sure, and you're not going to mess something up, especially with all the different time zones, countries, language barriers, et cetera. But the assumption with this is a capability. It's not, oh, we're short on pilots, so we're going to go down to one pilot in the cockpit. It's, well, everything's hit the fan and you need to be able to get a plane from point A to point B. And maybe that's, you got one person and one boom operator to make it happen. That's kind of the assumption I went with.
Yeah, I don't disagree with your comments, you know, and I'll say this, you know, the one pilot, one boom, especially, you know, the concept was you got two pilots and two booms on an airplane. It's a KC-46 that can both receive and give gas. If you approach it with a risk-informed concept, then that plane can, you know, almost be a two-for-one, right? You know, so that, again, that was a fantastic evolution. And by the way, a demonstration of my three W's too. Will it into existence, wither the resistance, weather the personal and professional attacks. I'm certain, I don't look at social media on me, but I know there's memes about me on that one. So, but you know, but it's a capability I need. I'm not making a comment on commercial flying here. Okay. I'm making a comment on what it takes to win. And it turns out that a boom operator in the right seat can talk on the radios and run a checklist. Okay. Does that mean they can talk on the radios and run a checklist when you have a V1 cut? We're probably not there, but you know, for the operational capability that this command needs for everybody to be successful, you know, I think it was a good evolution, and it's something that we should continue working on. It proved that there's plenty to work on, and it was successful. So, you know, I'm pretty confident that these are the capabilities we need. You know, if we get to a point where there's a different force mix in terms of more capable tankers, you know, you might want to readdress that. But as a stepping stone to the max endurance operations, again, these aren't things we necessarily want to do. These are things we have to do. These are things that we do to get the most value out of the fleet that we have. There's dynamics in the future that can change it. But you know, these are capabilities that the joint force will benefit from.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's one of the pieces is, and you've hit it home, like you're not making a commercial airline statement because the two are not the same. Everyone sees the commercial airline side like, well, no, this
this is not good, but we're not trying to do the same thing, which in the commercial side of the house, I agree. We don't be down that path, but I know we are closing in on your time again. It's very gracious of you to take the time.
I got time for you, brother. I got time for you, man. Keep going.
I do want to hit on Afghanistan, some mental health, and if you'll hang around for a There I Was story or two, that'd be great. But I think talking about Afghanistan, the exit of Afghanistan, obviously I had Colonel Pelbath, had Voodoo on the podcast, a whole host of other C-17 pilots, including, which it won't see the light of day for quite a while, the aircraft commander from taking off with planes surrounding people on it. Again, golf clap to all those crews doing pilot stuff is what I equate it to, like making it happen, especially in that chaotic situation. Not where you want to be, not where I want to be, not where you want to be, anything like that. So I know you spent a lot of time and effort trying to get recognition for a lot of the crews who were dealing with, quite frankly, unimaginable conditions and unexpected conditions as well. Can you talk to me a little bit about thoughts on that and the process to get them recognized?
Certainly. First of all, thanks for lowering your standards for me after PB and Voodoo. I realize I'm a rung down on that. They're both amazing. Somewhat frustrated throughout my career on recognition. And it came to a head with the OAR. You know, so just an incredible team. Executing, as you said, on the fly in a very demanding operational environment. And I initially started by asking permission for me, Air Mobility Command, to be able to award combat medals, which had not been the case for whatever reason. You know, I don't know. Every other, other commands could do it, but for whatever reason, Air Mobility Command could not. So, and I was very grateful that the SECAF and the CSAF supported me on that. By the time I got that authority, the ability to affect the OAR had expired. So I once again had to ask for an extension, and I was granted that. So, you know, at the end of the day, I'm extremely grateful for the authority they extended me to adjudicate it. But it was also very clear that I could not make things perfect. I could only make things better. When it came to the recognition, you know, I believe that that recognition is an important part of what we do. We don't do things for medals and recognition, but we should always back up our words with actions if appropriate. And recognition is a part of that. So one thing I did is I wanted to handle the recognition in command channels. Okay, so I convened a board of commanders that were responsible in Air Mobility Command for this. I reviewed all of the intel record. I reviewed all of the GDSS and the systems that we used for mobility record. I reviewed all of the mission recap reports personally. And I didn't delegate it to a board that was removed out of the command channels. And I made sure that I had data points from around the operation in considering what my recognition would be. So all that painted a very clear picture for me. And for the times that I needed to go outside and get data points, we took the time to do that. We had our A9 team do analysis on other recognition and where it fell. And so we took a very deliberate approach and came up with a scheme that made the recognition situation better, but not perfect. And so I was very, very happy with the team that helped me along through that. We did enormous work and had the opportunity at Airlift Transport Association, ATA. I'm sorry, Airlift Tanker Association, ATA. I'll have to buy a beer for that, by the way. That goes back to an older one. But got to recognize in front of families, got to recognize in front of peers, had a reunion of those that executed OAR and have them honor the Abbeygate 13, have them tell their stories in a very powerful, emotional, passionate, most sacred, honored way. and have all the come together, award some medals at bases and stuff like that. So I think that it is critical that we put walk behind the talk and that we demonstrate through action our appreciation for what those crews went through. I'm certain I didn't get it perfect. There's more work to do here, but my approach to the recognition was that, and then being able to be a good steward of that authority as well moving forward. We've had the ability to recognize other operations that are happening, and I continue to I resolve myself to continue to be an advocate for that. Over. Now, you almost had me crying there.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's an admin piece there that I never really thought about, but I made the assumption that as their mobility commander, you would have that authority. But you had to is that Secretary of the Air Force level to be able to delegate down to you?
Yes.
Interesting. Okay.
And I'm grateful that he did.
Yeah. Well, and absolutely. Again, it goes back to watching, you know, from afar what peers were going through in that time period. And again, I can't even imagine what that would have been like and the decisions they were having to make, especially during the overrun. I mean, and I've talked about this in the podcast, you know, typically the joke with like at least AMC, the feeling is it's like a Q3. So disqualify someone if they make a mistake is kind of like the knee jerk reaction. Not all the time, and that's a generalization. But, you know, no, just thinking those guys sitting at the end of the runway, seeing it, you know, trying to go down to the other end, seeing it overrun, not having, you know, performance data for, well, I don't know, they're how far down the runway? That's about right. I mean, making a decision and going with it. Again, golf clap.
Yeah, I think, you know, go back just a little bit and then to move forward on your comment there, you know, The other thing I was allowed to do, gratefully allowed to do with that authority was recognize the entire mobility team, you know, not just the flight crews, but the fly fix support. You know, when we close the crew entrance door, we're a crew. And it doesn't matter if you're a crew chief or a Raven or, you know, somebody else that's on to support a different part of the mission. You know, we all run chains, throw straps, you know, help. And I would say that, especially in that mission, it was everybody required to survive. You know, what's it like to have 500 people in an airplane without a bathroom? What's it like to not have the security and the checks of the people that came on? What's it like to be taken off and being told that you have somebody with an explosive on board? What's it like to hold over your destination for 5 hours? You know, when you know that there's suffering going on in the back of your airplane, you know, those things needed to be accounted for more prominently in the recognition. And so, you know, I was happy to award, you know, not just the flight crews, which is the traditional approach, but also the entire fly fix support team that made that happen. Those crews, I brag about the mobility culture. The mobility culture is really good at handling any operational environment you throw at it. And that should be celebrated. And I think that as you describe the mechanics of what it means to be mobility, what it meant to be mobility on that, you know, during those 17 days, you know, we have a lot to celebrate there, and yet it's not really a celebratory cause. I mean, this is insight into our future. A contested environment, very long distances, not a whole lot of communication. A joint force that needs to be integrated tactically as the situation is developing. I mean, there's a whole lot of things we need to work on, and we took very seriously in the AOR. In the AAR. And it significantly had a role in how we design Mobility Guardian. Is how can we take these insights and use it to predict what may happen in the Pacific. And then as a staff now, the mobility culture of a staff is predict what the environment is going to be like and start doing the three things I talked about. Let's make best use of the value we have. Let's go get value we don't have. And then let's demand from technology and industry things that we need to make our lives better. So, you know, all that was born from the highly emotional events that you described there. I could not be more proud of the team from the crews, every single one of them, magnificently, the highest standards of not just what it means to be an American, but what it means to be an airman and a mobility airman. And we've got to harness that and buy down the risk in the future as best we can to be worthy of them, to be worthy of them, so that we don't put crews in that position again.
Cliche to say, right? But the people make it happen. And that is the truth with the Air Force. And that's what makes, I think, the Air Force great, is the people you work with. Everyone, you know, 99.9% of the people you work with, they all want to win from every aspect of it. I've always said, I don't know if this is true, but to sit in the cockpit, you know, there's about 700 people that are behind you that got you into that cockpit. And if someone is not doing their job, it is not going to work out. So it is definitely a team effort when it comes to that. So I think that's great to obviously recognize people making that happen. No jet in the fuel, it's not flying. Plane's broken, it's not flying.
You got it right. So it's the your value to the mission is not proportional to your proximity of the cockpit. You know, yeah, you know, it takes an entire team, fly fix support to make it happen. And it, you know, and oftentimes you're relied on people that don't even understand, you know, the relationship to what's going to happen, you know, 1,000 miles away. But they still do it, right? And how do you, and you know, this gets back to your comment on the memo, how do you unite 110,000 people on a direction? And it takes continuous communication, continuous emphasis, and it takes continuous motivation, you know, and direct supervision, leadership commander, you know, talented NCOs, the whole ecosystem of what it means to produce a mission. And I think we're, you know, we're in a good spot. You know, I always describe, you know, from where we were to where we are is an A plus. A combination of the work done and the leadership. Where we are to where we need to be, you know, we're still at an upper C maybe. Only a comment on the things we need to do. The professionalism, the dedication, the motivation, all that still exists at an A-plus level. But we've got work. I mean, there is plenty more work to do here.
Yeah, messaging and getting the buy-in is so important. Yeah, I think we were fortunate on my last deployment. It was such a small contingent there that on the weekend, we could actually host everyone on base, whoever wanted to come, and we would play back the drops from that week. You'd have a pilot talking about what was going on, and you saw the buy-in from the guy or gal guarding the gate, the maintainer, because when the jets take off, they're gone for 6, 7, 8 hours and have no idea. So getting that buy-in, and where I saw that being really important was there, because you back up to when I showed up to Shaw and I was getting my teeth cleaned, you know, dental hygienist is going to work there and there's an 8-ship just taking off. I mean, it's so loud.
Love it.
And asking like, well, what do you do? Oh, you're a pilot? What do you fly? And you know, as the jets are just, and you're like, that is problematic because obviously not being aware of how important her job was, right, and what is going on. So I can understand having the challenge of messaging and yep, communication is constant and persistent.
Amen. Amen. Hey, do you want to go back to mental health again?
I would like to touch on that. And then if you got a few minutes just for there I was, but I know Perfect. We're running long on the time, so we got to cut short, but I would like to talk about mental health. That's popping up on the radar, I think, from the civilian side to the military side of the house, especially for pilots. So can you talk about some of the AMC initiatives going on right now?
Certainly. You know, there's a bit of a story here, you know, that starts back to the first, you know, essentially commander's call I had with my wing commanders in the fall of 21. Where actually PB was a big part of this, you know, where we had some crews that had executed OAR, you know, kind of present to the command echelon their thoughts on what it meant to execute that mission. And so, you know, it was, and there was legitimate impact mentally on what it meant. You know, I talked about some of the impacts on a crew. What does it mean to save 100,000 people, but the last flight out, look down and see 100,000 more, you know, or even numbers bigger than that, right? And, you know, so there is an impact there. I have a retired command chief, Anthony Brinkley, who I served with and was doing some work with us on this event and with another friend, Janelle McCauley. And we have this concept of warrior heart, right? And it's mind, body, craft. We always focus on body and craft. You know, it's nothing to go PT. It's nothing to go to the doctor when you're not feeling well. It's nothing to go to the dentist when you need a cleanup or a checkup. When it comes to craft, you know, you get all the training time you need. You get the sorties you need to get the sim you need. You get the checklist, the CBTs, all that stuff. But when it comes to mind, we treat it differently. We treat it like it's an emergency room procedure only. We don't talk about how we can strengthen it. We don't talk about how we can develop grit. We don't talk about how we can develop a will to win. We don't talk about it in terms of being on the same level as body and craft. And it, at the end of the day, we want to eliminate stigma. We want to lower barriers. We want to increase access and options. For the majority of the people, it's as simple as, you know, having a network of bros and sisses that can keep you tight and keep you sane and keep you, grounded on, you know, what you need to be successful. And then there's people that need a little bit more than that. Sometimes it's a peer talk in a different way. Sometimes it's a visit to a counselor. Sometimes it's a visit to a chaplain, and all those things need to exist. And there's nothing wrong with either of them. So, and then Brinkley challenged me. He said, "Minahan, if you cared about mental health so much, then make an appointment and put it on your calendar." And so I did. And then four people could see it because it's only the front office that can see my calendar. And so then we tweeted it, you know, back in early 22. And, you know, that started a pretty, believe it or not, this is going to surprise you, but I am social media shy. Okay. But that started a pretty big conversation in social media on mental health. Okay. And then I parked in front and I rode the elevator that nobody rides. And I sat in the waiting room that nobody likes to be in. And I took the uptake on the computer. And then I went to the back for the verbal uptake. And then I had the meeting with the counselor. And what I discovered was what I thought I was doing for everybody else, I was actually doing for me. Okay. That it turns out if you're in the Pentagon on 9/11, that you might have some things to talk about. It turns out that if you pack a body in ice while deployed, that you might have a few things to talk about. It turns out that if you've carried a heavy weight of command in combat and crisis, that you might have a few things to talk about. And then that's all it is it's talking about. And you're talking to a professional that can help you make put perspective on it. And we all see the negative outcomes when it comes to mental health. And, you know, the numbers are atrocious and we've got to get after that in a new way. So warrior heart, mental health, will to win, strengthening the mind, all those things exist in my Air Force, in my family, in my command, in my headquarters, all that. And we've got to give commanders a toolkit that can handle the wide array. And then I think the biggest thing we need to do is eliminate the stigma. I'll say one last thing provocatively here. You know, if you want to look, if you want to hear from a pilot that has PTSD, you're talking to one right now. Okay? So there should be no stigma on this. We've done amazing things for this nation. Okay? And we've got to break out of the American culture that drinks and buries these feelings so that we can bring them to the forefront and create an environment where we grow stronger from our experiences and don't bury them so that they come out in negative ways. So there you go.
If you're an AMC pilot or air crew and you go to mental health, that's not an automatic to NIF.
Nope.
I think getting over that, and even aware, my only exposure was going to do the brain test before deployment where you had to do the cognitive test. So they had a baseline. Yep. I remember walking by and this like bulletproof glass for like the check-in. So you're like, yeah, you don't want to come here. Obviously you got some serious problems if you're showing up here, right?
Yeah. The team here has worked very hard on affecting the directives that the Air Force has used when it comes to mental health. So the big things that are of high concern, those things remain intact. For the person that wants to come in and talk about their experience on their last mission, their experience during OAR, their experience during Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, you name the things, you know, we've created the space, data back, that allows you to come in and have the talk that you need to have and decide where you fit, you know, on the way forward. So I'm very proud of the team here, you know, both my SG, my A1, and certainly some pros that I have in my CAG have taken all of everything that you just said and that I've talked about and put it into a deliberate effort to make sure that we're doing the three things that I want, man. That's all I want. I want to eliminate the stigma. I want to lower the barriers. And I want to increase access and options. and give all that to commanders, give all that to airmen, so they can make the best decision possible for them.
Well, hopefully that makes its way out and it trickles out into the rest of the Air Force. I'm sure there's initiatives I'm just unaware of, but everyone's hearing it straight from you who fall underneath your command. Hopefully it trickles out into the civilian world, because it's definitely a big problem set. Yep. If I know we've run a little bit long here, your aide is probably pulling his hair out or her hair out, wherever they are. If you have a few more minutes, we'll do it there. We can do it. Otherwise, any parting shots or parting shots regardless.
How about I do this? How about I do parting shots? And then I will have time for a story or two at the end here. Parting shots. What a privilege to be on this team for 34 years. Wear this nation's cloth. Serve, you know, in this Air Force around the best people I know, the best humans I know, have worn the uniform or love somebody that wears the uniform of this country. And I extend that to our civilian airmen as well, and civilian DOD employees as well. And, you know, I told you earlier, I look like my dad on the outside. I feel like a lieutenant on the inside. There has been blood, sweat, and tears. There's been an enormous amount of joys. We have executed missions that are of the highest caliber and meaning to this country and to the joint force and to the world. And, you know, I am really, struggling is not the right word, but I you know, as you're Mike Minahan and winding up here in the next 5 weeks of this part of my life, you know, I can't help but feel the weight of the tremendous teams that have surrounded me at each point in my career. And I'm very grateful for that. My wife is grateful. My kids are grateful. We're excited about what comes next, but we also know that we're going to turn in, you know, we're going to turn into cheerleaders in a different way. And that, you know, my heart, my soul, my being is going to be on the wing of everybody out there serving. And, you know, and I'm just so incredibly grateful. You know, this chapter has been the most rewarding, challenging part. And, you know, I just don't have the words that can capture accurately, you know, my gratitude for amazing teammates. So that's my final thought.
Thanks for taking the time today. Thanks to your staff for putting this together. I look forward to hang around and hear a There I Was story or two. So again, thank you again for taking the time. I've enjoyed talking with you.
My pleasure.
Your online security has never been more important. Recently, hackers stole over 2.9 billion records from National Public Data. You might be asking yourself, what's National Public Data? Well, that's the service that private investigators, companies, and staffing services all use to do background checks. This information is now in the hands of hackers who say they're going to give away this information for free. I use a company called Aura to make sure that whenever my data pops up in places I don't want, I get notified immediately. They also go right to work trying to remove your information from data brokers, as well as they offer a whole host of other tools. And should the worst case happen, they offer up to $5 million in identity theft protection insurance. Protect yourself and your family today with Aura. You can use the link down below and get a 14-day free trial, and this will be enough time for Aura to go out there, scan the web, and see what information is out there that you really don't want. You can go to aura.com/afterburn or click the link down below in the description again to get 14 days free.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.